Despite the years, it all remains remarkably vivid. It was the last school day before a long Memorial Day weekend.
I think that I was probably in the bathroom shaving when Tom went out the door.
Did your wife take Eitan down the elevators?
No, since we're only on the third floor, we use the stairs.
Down the stairs and out onto Prince Street. It was a red letter day for first grader Eitan. For months, he'd been pestering his parents to walk alone to the school bus stop just two blocks away. Today, they finally agreed, and away he went.
In the early days, you and your wife took a lot of criticism about letting Eitan go by himself that day. That must have been tough.
Well, we did, but at some point in every parent's life, they send their children to school alone. Did we do it too early? Obviously, we did. It was very familiar territory. This was a very safe neighborhood. When you let them out of your sight, when they're 21?
Julie could have followed some of Eitan's path from their fire escape, but today she got busy with their other children. And Stan, a commercial photographer, went about his day with a photo shoot uptown.
It had to be at least 3 o'clock. Julie called, and she said that Eitan had not come home from school. I was probably down here in about 15 minutes and came up here, and
it's all still right there, isn't it?
At some point, he must have realized that things were going bad, and I still gag with the fear that this child must have felt. When he realized he was betrayed by an adult.
It was a story that captured the public's attention, and a storyline that anyone who not only even had a child, but even had a niece or a nephew, looked at that case and said, there, but for the grace of God, one glance the wrong way, one moment of inattention, you look, and they're gone.
There were no leads. There was no crime scene. They couldn't go dust for fingerprints. They didn't even know where he disappeared. At a certain point, it just becomes, there's nothing else to do.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Good evening.
Today's episode, Innocence Lost, the abduction of Eitan Peets. Now, Eitan was 6 years old when he disappeared from his Lower Manhattan neighborhood in 1979. His disappearance helped in the establishment of new legislation and new methods for tracking missing children. He was the first missing child to be pictured on milk cartons, actually. In 2010, Eitan's case was reopened by the New York County District Attorney's Office. A suspect was charged and indicted, and his trial ran from January of 2015 to May 2015, and it ended in a mistrial. Jury selection for a new trial began late this September, so a couple weeks ago. So this is not only a historic case, but it is an active case, and it has a trial expected later this year.
Yes, we'll have a few things to say about that.
Yes, a lot of things.
Yes.
Now, the anniversary of Eitan Peets' disappearance, May 25th, has been designated National Missing Children's Day in the United States, and that's since 1983. The extensive media attention given to Eitan's disappearance is credited with creating more attention for missing children cases worldwide. This gives little solace to Eitan's parents, of course, who have suffered from this loss for over 35 years now. So we'll go over Eitan's disappearance, the search for him, the suspects, the trials, all that in our discussion today. But of course, first things first, let's read a couple of 5-star reviews and get our beer review before we move on down to the quiet end.
I'm ready for that.
Okay. So our first review is, I love the podcast by Battywack. If there were more than 5 stars, I would give them. I love everything about this podcast. The voices of the hosts are soothing and appealing. Those who call their delivery monotone should use a dictionary. The beer descriptions Dick offers are priceless. I don't drink beer, but I enjoy hearing his take on flavors. Caramel, brown bread, smoke, funky calling card, a tiny head. He even gives a history of some craft beers. My only complaint might be the silly bottle cap noise that they use every episode. which really sounds like a finger popping out of a cheek. Dick also applies his expertise as a pediatrician to the crimes they discuss. So that is from Battywack, and there's a little bit more, but it's kind of long, so I'm just going to say thanks a lot and welcome to the brewery, Battywack.
That's a nice review.
It is. It's thoughtful. He's put some thought into it.
Absolutely.
Or she has. Yeah.
Right.
And another one is An Enjoyable Listen by Ventil. And Ventil says, I just found this podcast and enjoy the quiet discussion of issues found throughout these cases. Thank you, Jill and Dick. Well, thank you, Ventil, and welcome to the brewery.
Welcome.
And another one is, I love this podcast by Dave E. Davis. And Dave E. Davis says, well researched and the hosts are charming. Listen to this podcast.
Absolutely. All of you people should listen to these podcasts.
Now, Dave E. Davis, that's kind of funny because when I was in junior high, I had a huge crush on a boy named Dave Davis. So I hope it's not him.
Maybe it is.
Maybe it is. I don't know. It's kind of scary. Because I found him very intimidating. Everybody liked him. He was the best-looking boy in the 7th grade, Dave Davis.
Uh-oh, I should be afraid then.
So if Dave Davis, if you're from Redford, Michigan, well, I was going to say give me a call, but don't give me a call.
Wait a minute.
That's funny. No, I'm sure there's more than one Dave Davis, but that's funny. So welcome to the brewery, Dave. I'm sure you're not the one I was worried about.
We're pining for.
So let's do the beer review, Dick.
Well, tonight's beer is a New York beer. It's called Bon Bon 2X TNT Double IPA. It's a long title, isn't it?
It is. It better be a good beer with all that behind it.
It's a great beer. It's brewed by Single Cut Beersmiths out of Astoria, Queens in New York.
Okay.
So as it says, it's a double IPA, which we've talked about before. This beer is a hazy gold color with a big, huge white head that leaves lots of foamy rings in the glass. So it's a very visually pretty beer. There's a huge citrus aroma, some tropical fruit, a little tiny bit of pine. And the taste goes that way also. Grapefruit, melon, some mango.
I really like grapefruit in a beer. I've noticed that. That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's some that are actually grapefruit juice added.
Oh.
Even better.
Yummy. Yeah.
And there's a little late pine with Bon Bon. This is a light and smooth beer in the mouth, and it has a very clean finish. So there's not a lot of stuff going on at the end there.
Okay. I don't know if I could tell that from a beer. It just means once you swallow it, it's gone.
Right. There's not,
no lingering aftertaste.
There's nothing lingering.
Okay.
But it's a very nice beer, and this was sent to me by a guy from upper state New York who really likes this brewery, and I agree with him. It's a great beer.
Okay, and what's it called again?
Bon Bon 2X TNT Double IPA.
All right. Well, let's open it up and head on down.
Okay. Well, the quiet end is truly a quiet end tonight. Now that the Red Sox have been eliminated from the playoffs, nobody's real interested in the other baseball games going on right now.
No, it's so, kind of a sad atmosphere.
It's almost funereal.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but
well,
okay.
For us Red Sox fans, it is. It's terrible.
Okay.
But to our advantage, it's quiet, and we'll be able to do this without anybody leaning over our shoulders and kibitzing.
Well, it'll be very cozy, yes.
All right.
Okay.
Let's go.
Okay, so Eitan Peets. He was born in New York on October 9th of 1972, and he lived in Manhattan in a loft building near the corner of Prince Street and West Broadway. It was near the end of his kindergarten year on May 25th, 1979, at around 8 a.m., when Eitan left his apartment by himself, and this was for the first time. He was supposed to walk 2 blocks to catch the school bus at West Broadway and Spring Street. But Eitan never reached the bus stop. At school, his teacher noticed his absence, but failed to report it to the principal.
Yeah, I guess back in the late 70s, it wasn't done that way.
No.
Not like this day and age. Kid doesn't show up for school. parents are called right away.
And a lot of these changes were made because of parents like Eitan's that saw the hole in the system and how these things happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we'll find out some statistics about children that are abducted. And you really need to get going within the first couple hours.
Absolutely, yes. So when he didn't come home at the end of the school day, his mother did call the police. And there was an extensive search for Eitan, which began that evening. Nearly 100 police and a team of bloodhounds searched for weeks for Eitan. Now, Stan Pates, Eitan's father, he was actually a professional photographer, and he had a collection of photos of Eitan. His photos were printed on missing child posters and posted all over the city. So Eitan's face was pictured on milk cartons, and it was also projected on screens in Times Square. So this was all new stuff that really hadn't happened.
Right. This is groundbreaking stuff.
Yes. And very few leads came in, unfortunately.
Right. But this case, thanks to the parents, they really pushed it.
They did, yes.
And just as, not as an analogy, but not too long after Eitan disappeared, Adam Walsh was abducted.
Yes.
And his father, John Walsh, has played a very significant role.
Huge. Huge.
In looking for abducted missing children.
Yes, and Eitan's mother, Julie Pates, actually had a lot of interaction with John Walsh and his wife when Adam Walsh went missing.
Right.
Yeah.
So these two cases are the groundswell of what's going on today.
Yeah, they were within a couple of years of each other.
Right.
So in 1983, which was about 4 years after Eitan went missing, President Ronald Reagan designated May 25th. The date of Eitan's disappearance as National Missing Children's Day. But still no trace of Eitan had been found.
Right. And this was an extensive publicity.
Absolutely.
And just no clues whatsoever.
No. I mean, actually, media and police went right into their loft and stayed there for the first week.
Right.
And there was nothing to find because he hadn't gotten on the bus. And no one had seen what happened to him, and it was only two blocks.
Yeah. I mean, that's, talk about your crime of opportunity.
You know, absolutely.
This little kid walks from his front steps to the bus stop two blocks away and disappears.
And one thing that we'll learn from the statistics is that most of these are crimes of opportunity.
Right.
It's not like they've studied one certain child. It's just that these kind of people see a child that's vulnerable and move in.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, in 1985, Assistant United States Attorney Stuart R. Grabois received Eitan's case, and that's when he identified Jose Antonio Ramos as his primary suspect in this case. Ramos was a convicted child sexual abuser, and also he'd been friends with Eitan's former babysitter. Now, she wasn't really his babysitter. Her name was Sandy. I'm not going to say her last name because I don't want to do that. Because she's an innocent person. But she was actually hired to help walk Eitan and his friends to the bus before Eitan was allowed to walk alone because there was a bus strike. So she'd been hired by Julie Pates to just help walk the children to the bus.
Yeah, so she wasn't like a nanny or a sitter or anything. She just performed that one function.
Yeah, but she'd been in the home.
Yeah.
And she'd interacted. Yeah.
I'm just wondering how she knew this guy Ramos or how he knew her, because they don't seem to live on the same plane of existence.
Well, he was actually her boyfriend for some time, but he went under a different name.
Yeah.
So he was kind of a complex character. There was more to him than you might think.
Quite.
Yeah.
But he lived in a culvert or something.
Well, he had the culvert, okay. But he also had other places where he lived. But the culvert seemed to be the place where he kept his pictures of children and stuff like that, the tunnel. Yeah. So some boys had accused Ramos of trying to lure them into a drain pipe. And that's where they thought that Ramos had spent a lot of time. And it was in the area where he was living back in 1982. So when police searched the drain pipe, they found photographs of Ramos and some young boys that looked like Eitan. And some of them, he's posing with the young boys. It's really quite disturbing.
More than disturbing.
Yeah. So he'd been luring boys in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Offering them things. He had book bags. He would take their book bags and then have them come to get them. So he was definitely a pedophile.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know how many of these children he molested, but he certainly had feelings in that direction.
He did.
Yeah.
And didn't he have a picture of Eitan?
I don't think he had Eitan specifically, no.
He had kids that looked like him.
Yes.
Or resembled him.
Well, he seemed to like to have pictures of blonde boys with blue eyes.
Yeah, in the appropriate age.
Well, in the most inappropriate age, well, yes.
The appropriate age for him.
Yes. And when he was asked about that in an interview, he said, well, I really don't have the Viking thing. I don't know
what's that?
What that meant. I guess referring to blondes, okay. Vikings. He's a sick individual.
He's everything we've read about him. He's seriously ill.
Yeah, and he even admits to it quite a bit. So Grabois found out that Ramos had been in custody in Pennsylvania for another child molestation case. So it was in 1990, Grabois was finally able to help prosecute Ramos. So he became deputized as a state attorney general in Pennsylvania, and then he helped in a case against Ramos for sexually abusing children in Pennsylvania. And part of his idea of doing that is that hopefully he would learn more about Eitan's case and maybe get a confession.
Yeah, we've seen interviews with Grabois.
Yes.
He seems pretty on the ball.
He was tenacious.
Yes.
Yes. Because he really felt that Ramos had done this crime. And he really seemed to empathize with the Pateses.
Yeah, for sure.
And what they were going through.
And I really like his thinking. I don't know if he's changed his thinking since Hernandez has been on trial, but you gotta like Ramos for doing this.
Yes, he seems like the most likely suspect, and I believe that now as well, yes.
Yes.
I don't know what Grabois thinks, but a lot of people think that Ramos is the person who did this. But we'll get to that. There's a lot about that.
I know. There is lots of discussion.
Yeah. So anyway, when Ramos was first questioned by Grabois, Ramos said that on the day Eitan disappeared, that he had taken a young boy back to his apartment to rape him. But he wouldn't specifically say that it was Eitan.
No, and the way that comes across is that you're not sure he was mixing fantasy with reality or what.
Right, and I think though that he was clever enough to mix it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was using it to his advantage to be vague about everything.
Yeah. Ramos told Grabois that he was, quote unquote, 90% sure it was the boy he later saw on TV. But he didn't use Eitan's name. He also claimed he'd put the boy on a subway.
Yeah, he'd given a couple different stories.
Then in 1991, while Ramos was incarcerated, a jailhouse informant told Grabois and FBI agent Mary Galligan that Ramos had told him that he knew what had happened to Eitan.
Hmm.
Ramos even drew a map of Eitan's school bus route, saying that he knew that Eitan's stop was the third one on the route. And that's pretty suspicious stuff.
Well, Sandy, the babysitter, she knew the route because she would walk the kids and she knew
right.
The times. And they think that's where he got that information, aside from just observing.
So, but, you know, as you said, he was familiar with the Pates family.
Yes.
And he was a prime suspect in this. But investigators didn't have enough evidence to prosecute him.
No, and it was very frustrating for Stan and Julie Pates because they really believed that he was a good lead,
yeah.
Which makes sense to me. A lot of people thought so.
Right. And they didn't prosecute him, but the Pateses sued him in civil court.
Yes.
Is that something that's coming up later and I shouldn't have said anything?
No, it'll be coming up soon. I just had a couple more things to talk about first.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, Dave Davis wouldn't do that, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know. Dave was the guy in seventh grade. He's God.
Yeah. So the New York Post actually ran a special feature story on missing children in 1999. And they named Ramos as a prime suspect in Eitan's disappearance in that article. So Eitan was declared legally dead in 2001. And Ramos was declared to be responsible for his death. So this was when they had the civil case in 2004, but he was never criminally prosecuted for that, because Ramos denied that he killed Eitan.
Sure.
Now, he served a 20-year prison sentence in the state correctional institution in Pennsylvania for other child molestation charges. And Stan and Julie Pates were awarded a symbolic sum, they call it, of $2 million in this civil case.
Well, sure.
He had no money.
He had nothing, so they weren't ever going to get one penny from him.
No, and obviously it wasn't about the money. It was just about to get some court to call him responsible.
They wanted him named as a responsible party.
And it wasn't happening criminally, which I kind of see. I don't know. I'm not particularly fond of being critical of the police, but it seems like this was something that should have been pursued better, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I get that impression.
Yeah.
But I think there's some parallels between him and Hernandez in terms of their mental status.
You think so?
Yeah. And thinking about, well, we can't prosecute him because he didn't give a full confession. He's clearly nuts.
Yeah, but just with, you know how they get confessions out of people that don't do things? This guy seems like they could have got a confession out of him if they really wanted to.
I think so.
Don't you think? If he's already given a 90% confession.
They could probably ratchet it up to 100%.
I would think if they really wanted him that they could have. I would think so.
Yeah.
But, of course, no money was ever collected.
None at all.
Now, interesting, I thought, was that every year, so on the anniversaries of Eitan's birthday and the anniversaries of his disappearance, Stan Pates sends Ramos a copy of Eitan's missing child poster. So this was up until a few years ago, obviously.
Huh. So he wants to keep reminding him.
Yeah, and on the back he would type, "What did you do to my little boy?" And he would send that to him. So two times a year, in October and May. For many years, he sent him that. And the one good thing about all this is that Ramos was in prison. Maybe not for Eitan, but at least he was where he couldn't hurt any children.
He wasn't hurting children.
Right. Now, he was released from prison in 2012, but he was arrested soon after his release. And I read about this. It was for a Megan's Law violation. He failed to register as a sex offender. Now, registration as a sex offender and community notification of the sex offender's location, those are both required under the Jacob Wetterling Crimes Against Children and Sexually Violent Offender Registration Act. That's a mouthful.
It is.
And Megan's Law, a federal law created in response to the murder of Megan Kenka. So, for this, he was put back in prison.
In when? 2012?
Yes.
And he's still there?
Yes. Now, Eitan's case was reopened in 2010, though. And in 2012, the FBI and the NYPD investigators, they did an excavation of the Soho basement. So, this was at 127B Prince Street, very near to the Pates' home. And the residence had been newly renovated just a short time after Eitan's disappearance. The basement had actually been the workshop and the storage space for a handyman there. So the connection here is that the handyman, Othniel Miller, was a suspect for a short time. This was after someone notified police that the concrete floor in Othniel's workshop appeared uneven. So they brought in cadaver dogs, and the cadaver dogs did react to the area as if a body may have been buried at that site.
Yeah, this is many, many years after. I was trying to get some information about how long a cadaver dog could detect.
Oh, yeah.
But I couldn't find anything. But it just seems to me, this is over 20 years.
Sure.
And there's still possibly a scent that a cadaver dog can pick up.
And it's beneath the cement. Well, obviously it's not that reliable, is it, when it gets to that point? Because it didn't turn out to be anything.
Right.
So, Othniel reportedly saw Eitan the day before his disappearance. He'd actually given Eitan a dollar for some chores that day. So, I guess he would have kids do, like, little chores and give them a dollar. You know, like you do with kids. Oh, do that. And kids get excited. And when Eitan first went missing, Othniel Miller had welcomed police into the basement and said that they could examine it. So he did say that he'd given Eitan the dollar and he'd seen him the day before, but he said he'd had nothing to do with Eitan's disappearance or that he didn't hurt Eitan in any way. And he had no history of that.
Yeah, he had nothing in his past records.
No.
That would indicate him being pedophilic.
That's right. And as we know, the motive for kidnapping children at that age is pedophilia.
Exactly.
Yeah. So he wasn't a suspect at that time, but when the concrete was freshly poured, Othniel invited police to tear it up. He said, "I don't mind if you do it as long as you pay me back for it," but they declined doing that. And no sign of Eitan's remains were found from the 2012 excavation of that area either. So it wasn't until 2012 that Othniel Miller was really cleared as a suspect. So over those, what, how many years? Over 20 years? Mm-hmm. He kind of lived as a semi-suspect with people kind of looking at him funny.
Sure.
And he really said that he would rather that they had dug it up back then and just cleared everything up. Of course.
Well, hindsight's good, right?
Yeah, but the police, they thought it was too expensive and didn't bother. So, I don't know what you say about that. I guess they do what they have to do.
Yeah, it just sounds, I'm not sure. The police have never said anything about, no, we refuse to pay them. It might just be this guy's story.
Well, not even just paying him, but I think there's a lot of effort and expense involved in digging up cement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And it wasn't until later that the cadaver dogs were brought in. So they had no reason, really, except that he gave Eitan a dollar.
Exactly.
So he really didn't need to be a suspect, probably ever.
No.
No. So that's how that went. So then on May 24th of 2012, the New York Police Commissioner, Raymond Kelly, he announced that a man was in custody who'd actually implicated himself in Eitan's disappearance. So this man was identified as Pedro Hernandez, and he was from New Jersey. He was 51 years old, and he had confessed to strangling Eitan. Hernandez was 18 years old, working at a convenience store in Eitan's neighborhood at the time of Eitan's disappearance.
So he could have seen Eitan.
Yes.
Or could have known of him.
Yeah, he was, you know, on the route to the bus stop, near the bus stop.
Yeah.
So he told police that he had strangled Eitan, but then threw his body into the garbage. But he'd said that he'd strangled him in the basement, that he'd thrown Eitan's backpack and whatnot behind the boiler, was it? Behind something in the basement.
Right. And,
yeah.
And the body was put into some container in an alleyway.
Yeah. And taken out to the trash.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing with him was, he was also not a pedophile. And he didn't even say that he'd done anything to Eitan. He said he just had the urge to kill him.
Right. He just felt his hands around his neck.
Yeah. So he was charged with second-degree murder, but police had no physical evidence, no eyewitnesses to corroborate his confession. So the thing about him is he was a schizophrenic. He was 18 years old when this happened. And so now he's 51 when they arrest him. So from 18 to 51, he hasn't done anything to children. He hasn't committed any murders.
Right.
He
not,
also,
not that it's known of. Anyway,
well, he hasn't confessed to any. There's been no evidence he did any.
Right.
So it just seems very strange that they believed his confession so easily.
I think there's a lot of strange things about this.
Yeah. So I was going to have you tell us a little bit about schizophrenia, paranoia, that kind of thing, what Pedro was dealing with.
He was dealing with a lot.
Yeah, you know? I thought so.
And in addition to this, he has a very borderline IQ. He's got an IQ of around 70.
That's pretty low.
So there's a lot of things against him.
Yes.
And makes me wonder about the confession. But anyway, so schizophrenia is a mental disorder characterized by abnormal social behavior and a failure to understand what is real. So common symptoms include false beliefs, unclear or confused thinking, hearing voices, reduced social engagement and emotional expression, and lack of motivation. People with schizophrenia often have additional mental health problems, such as anxiety disorders, depression, and substance abuse.
Yeah.
These symptoms typically come on gradually and begin in young adulthood. So here this guy is 18 years old working in a neighborhood grocery.
Right.
It's probably when he started first having symptoms.
Right. That would be about normal, wouldn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
So causes of schizophrenia include both environmental and genetic factors. This was interesting to me. Possible environmental factors may include being raised in a city.
Really?
Yeah.
Never heard that before.
Cannabis use, marijuana use.
Okay.
Some kinds of infections. Parental age, older paternal age can be implicated in it.
They saw a connection with that in autism also, so that's interesting.
Right. And poor nutrition during pregnancy.
Wow.
Diagnosis of schizophrenia is based on observed behavior and a person's reported experiences. Unfortunately, there's no objective test you can do to diagnose schizophrenia.
Sure. So you need someone who's really an expert.
Right.
Yeah. So how was Hernandez diagnosed?
He was diagnosed by observation and listening to his stories.
Okay.
And I'm assuming that this was done by a psychiatrist.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
So, you know, a lot of these things that are typical for schizophrenics make me think that his confession wasn't a real confession.
Well, wouldn't you say that schizophrenics are kind of known for making false confessions? There's that paranoia guilt aspect, right?
Well, I don't know that I'd say they're known for it. I think that, as we've said, they can mistake fantasy from reality.
So that makes them vulnerable to confessing because they're very suggestive. Well, and if you say this happened, or if they're watching the news and see something happen and someone says, did you do that? Their mind can very easily think, oh, did I do that? Maybe I did do that.
Well, if you're looking at it that way, yeah, they can be kind of coerced.
Sure.
And the other thing was that the confession came after several hours of interrogation on this guy.
Right, right.
And we don't know what happened in those hours. The video cam wasn't turned on until the confession was obtained.
I find that suspicious, and I don't think I'm the only one that thinks so.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It makes me think that they worked him over for a while, figuratively, of course.
Yes, right.
And broke him down, and when he was ready to confess, that's when they turned on the camera.
Right. Yeah. It makes me think of Making a Murderer, Stephen Avery's nephew. Was it Dassey that his name was? Just the police had him so turned around that he pretty much said whatever they told him to.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I really think that can be done quite easily, especially with an IQ of 70.
I'm just kind of amazed
he's so vulnerable.
Decided to prosecute this guy.
Well, you know,
I mean, looking at it, it just seems to me like it's a loser case.
Right. In other countries, if you're a minor or if you have an intellectual disability, you can't be interviewed by the police without a guardian or a lawyer.
Right.
So this is something that the United States has a problem with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So statements by Hernandez's sister Nina and Thomas Rivers, a leader of a charismatic Christianity group at a Roman Catholic church in Camden, New Jersey, indicated that Hernandez had publicly confessed to the church people in the 80s to killing a child.
In the 80s. So it took him 25 years to communicate this to the authorities?
I know. That's interesting, isn't it?
That's another red flag.
Yeah. And also his story changed a lot. It wasn't always consistent.
Right.
Yeah.
And we always got to remember, a confession doesn't equal a conviction.
Absolutely not. You need other evidence.
Right.
But a lot of people think, oh, he confessed. Well, that's shut.
He must have done it.
Of course he did it. That's just open and shut.
Doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. And thank goodness it doesn't, because there are a lot of vulnerable people who do confess to things they didn't do.
There are.
Especially under scrutiny and pressure.
Yeah, we've done a couple cases like that where confession's been obtained.
Yeah.
Under some form of duress.
Sure. Yep.
And it's not a true confession.
Right. And that doesn't help anybody.
No.
I mean, it might fix their short-term problem of finding someone to prosecute, but it's not helping society overall to do something like that.
It certainly isn't.
And you're really not looking at the big picture. Now, a New York grand jury indicted Hernandez. That was in November 14th, 2012, and that was on charges of second-degree murder and first-degree kidnapping. His lawyer has stated that Hernandez was diagnosed with schizotypal. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It's the first time I've seen that word.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Personality disorder, including hallucinations. Now,
I mean, that's just fancier talk for saying he's schizophrenic.
Yeah.
So.
And like we said, he also had a very low IQ of 70, and that, I guess, is considered the border of intellectual disability. But I think that's an intellectual disability compared to most people.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So why are they prosecuting Hernandez?
Well, you know why. Because he confessed.
Yes.
And they wanted some closure to this case.
Yes.
So they could say, we got the guy.
Right. On December 12th of 2012, Hernandez pleaded not guilty. And in April 2013, Harvey Fishbein, a defense lawyer for Pedro Hernandez, filed a motion to dismiss the case, citing that Hernandez's confession in one of the nation's most notorious child disappearances was false. It was filled with questionable claims, and it was made after almost 7 hours of police questioning, which we do not have video or audio witnessing of, so who Right. knows what happened during that time.
Exactly. I'd be just so suspicious of that. And yet they went ahead with the prosecution. Just seems strange to me.
Right. Now, what about that when Ramos was caught with the three boys? Was that in 2012?
Oh, no. That was 30 years prior.
Oh, so that was right after the disappearance.
It wasn't too long after Eitan's disappearance.
Okay.
And this is another reason to like Ramos for doing it.
Okay.
There was an officer, this is in 82, an officer, Joseph Gelfand, was transferred from the New York Police Narcotics Division to VICE, mm-hmm. the Public Morals Division. So they, about 1 week into this new job, he was taken around by a policeman in the pedophile unit for a ride-along. They went to Times Square and to Playland Arcade. This was described as a pedophile magnet. And the police officer taught Officer Gelfand about chicken hawks, which are older men who lingered at the Playland offering kids quarters for sex acts.
Ew.
Yeah. So that first night, Gelfand noticed a shaggy-haired man with a group of blonde preteen boys.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his partner tailed them, got hung up in traffic, so Gelfand got out of the car and kept tracking them, followed them through a building up to a roof, and he observed the shaggy-haired guy unzipping his fly.
Hmm.
So he drew his gun, put a halt to the proceedings. Two of the boys ran away.
Yeah.
Talked to the third boy, said, what did this guy say to you? And the kid said, again, preteen kid, said that the man, the shaggy-haired guy, said, I'll give you $10 if you let me suck your dicks.
Whoa.
So the man was taken to the police station, and his name turned out to be Jose Antonio Ramos.
So he's the guy that was in the tunnel.
He's the guy in the culvert.
Right. And also, he was the boyfriend of Sandy, the
right.
babysitter of ATAC.
Yep.
Yep. He's the one that drew the map. So this is huge red flags coming out here.
For sure.
Yep.
So he had a wallet, he had two knives, he had a Bible in his pockets. Praise the Lord.
Yeah.
In the wallet was a newspaper clipping from the drainage tunnel arrest and several pictures of blonde boys. He's sticking with his blonde boy theme.
Right.
So Gelfand called missing persons about this kid that they had. He describes missing persons as hanging up on him.
Yeah, he called missing persons because he knew about the A-10 Pates case.
Right.
And he remembered this tunnel incident. So now he's found the guy with the pictures, and the guy was found with some actual boys
right.
trying to do a sex act.
Think you could do something with that.
So he finds that significant, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And this is prior to Ramos moving to Pennsylvania and being arrested and imprisoned down there.
Okay.
This is before all this happened.
Right.
So he doesn't hear anything for a long time. He right. eventually called the DA's office, inquiring about the case against Jose Ramos, found out that the case had been dismissed.
Yeah, he'd been released.
He'd been released because none of the victims responded to the subpoenas or letters from the DA's office.
Sure.
And no one had even bothered to call or visit the victims' families in person. So the DA's office was negligent, and the police were negligent in following up on this.
So nothing happened with it.
Nothing happened with it.
No. And the thing is with these families... Not to be judgmental, but from it seems like these people were not the most diligent of families because the youngest boy who was left behind with Ramos was 9. It was 10:30 at night. He was out roaming the streets at the arcade by himself with other boys, I guess. Not by himself, but with other children.
Yes.
So it makes you think that maybe his parents weren't as on top of things as they could have been.
Well, that's an understatement.
Well, I'm trying to be very fair here.
No need to be.
Okay.
They were negligent.
Yes, they were definitely negligent
parents. They should have their parental rights terminated.
Yeah. So.
But it's tough to do if no one ever responds.
Sure. But if they don't respond, don't you think someone should go to the home and say something? Did anyone interview the parents?
Never.
They must have had to come to pick up their 9-year-old at the station. What happened with that?
Nothing.
It's just really odd, I think, that it wasn't followed up on.
It's dismaying.
A lot more could have been done.
Yes.
It's upsetting, yeah. So it was May 2013 that the Manhattan State Supreme Court Justice, Maxwell Wiley, ruled that the evidence was legally sufficient to support the charges against Pedro Hernandez in this case. So that case against Pedro Hernandez moved forward. He also ordered a hearing to determine whether the defendant's statements could be used at trial. So there was a hearing in September 2014 about whether Hernandez's statements... Now, these were statements made prior to police reading him his Miranda warning. And they were trying to find out in the hearing if it was legally admissible at trial. So what's with that? I thought that if you didn't read the rights, you couldn't use it.
We've seen enough cop shows and stuff that anything you say before you get your rights... read to you are inadmissible.
It
just didn't happen.
But they had a hearing about it, and they decided that it was only dependent on whether Hernandez felt free to leave in this time before he was read his rights. That seems very crooked to me. I don't like the way that was run.
You're really sidestepping the argument there.
I kind of feel like they just want to push this crazy, not so bright guy into prison and be done with it.
Yeah.
So he actually did go to trial, and this is based on only his confession, nothing else, right? Is there anything else?
There's not, well, the testimony of the preacher and his sister.
That he had confessed,
but other than the confession,
right?
There's nothing.
Right. So how reliable is the schizophrenic guy's story that has no basis of fact?
Well, as his attorney said, there's no reliability in it.
You
can't even begin to believe this statement.
I don't believe it at all. So the trial began in January of 2015, so not that long ago. And after jurors were deadlocked, they were deadlocked 11-1 for conviction. So that just scares the hell out of me. So 11 of these people were ready to convict him.
11 people.
Yep.
I think they started off with...
6-6.
6-6, and then 9-3, and then 11-1.
Right.
And the one holdout wasn't going to change his vote.
And I love him, let me just say. I had a lot of respect for this guy.
Yeah, because he was under intense pressure from his jury mates to change.
But he was very reasonable and he made sense.
He certainly does.
So this 11-1 deadlock, it resulted in a mistrial. And that was in May of 2015. So this one holdout who we're in love with was interviewed on the Today Show, and he made some incredibly valid points.
He certainly did.
So I don't know who the interviewer was. I've seen him before. Do you know what his name is on the Today Show? That He's like a young Matt Lauer.
No,
yeah. So he kept asking him, well, how could you do it? What were your reasons? Over and over again. Felt like he was hounding him. It was ridiculous.
He was, because he was asking the same question time and time again.
Because this guy was very clear.
Right.
So his name was Adam Siros. So reasons not to convict Hernandez, which he'd been asked over and over, and he gave some very clear reasons. So number one,
unchanging reasons.
Yes.
Even being asked the same question more than one time.
Yeah.
He didn't change his answers.
No. So he said that the interview was not recorded until the actual confession was recorded. So that's a point,
right,
which we've brought up. Also, Hernandez had a low IQ, so he really should have been supervised by an attorney or a guardian or someone.
He should have.
He shouldn't have been left to these smart, intimidating detectives, right?
Right.
And also that he has schizophrenia. And also that a question of his was that, would he kill at 18 years old and then have no other violent crimes up until he's 50?
For 30 years.
Yeah. It doesn't seem very likely.
Not in the least.
Now, also, a big one is no physical evidence.
Yeah, well, I'm less inclined to be that critical of that part, because many, many years have gone by. I wouldn't expect to find any physical evidence, really.
Well, no, you wouldn't in the current times, but back when it happened, a schizophrenic shouldn't be that organized and that clean about something like this. He said that he'd thrown the child's things behind something and that he'd put them in the trash.
And they never found any backpack or body or anything.
No. I mean, it's not that easy to kill someone and hide the body and never have anything connected to you.
Sounds very difficult to do.
An intellectually disabled or borderline intellectually disabled schizophrenic 18-year-old, what are the chances that he's going to commit this crime where he never gets caught? Or even questioned.
Hence no physical evidence.
Right.
And each year that goes by, there's going to be less likelihood of finding any physical evidence.
Yes.
So.
Yes, that seems like that's a train that is pulled out of the station a while ago.
Exactly.
Another big one to me is the idea of motive. What was his motive?
Well, you can turn that schizophrenia argument around and say that there wouldn't have to be a motive. It's just an impulse in his brain. So I don't think that's a strong argument. I think the other things are quite valid.
I think so. I think that if you're a schizophrenic and you're leaning towards violence, odds are that you're going to perpetrate that violence against someone in your life that you know.
Right.
You're not going to randomly pick up a child.
Well, you might. But it's not going to be a one-and-done deal. If you're a schizophrenic who's prone to violence.
Yes, and when someone kills a child like that.
Perpetuate that violence.
Yeah, but usually there's a sexual motive when someone kills a child like that.
Usually,
yes. Far and away, usually.
Usually.
Okay. So also, searches of the basement where he worked and of his home revealed nothing. And his stories and confessions over the years were inconsistent and unreliable. So, for example, he'd said a couple of times that he'd killed a dark-skinned child. Well, A-10 was not at all dark-skinned.
He was the fairest of fair.
Yes. So this Adam Siros, the holdout juror, he stated that, ultimately, I couldn't find enough evidence that wasn't circumstantial to convict Hernandez.
Right.
And I would argue that there wasn't even a lot of circumstantial evidence.
No, I think that's a valid argument.
That
things changed and there wasn't enough evidence of any kind.
Right.
So
the confession, really.
We get back again to why did you guys prosecute that case?
Yeah. But Siros, he's a healthcare consultant, and he also said that he thought the mental illness plea for Hernandez had not been fully explored as it could have been. So he really didn't think they addressed that enough, the defense team.
Right.
Yeah. So while the double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment typically prevents a person from being tried more than once for the same crime, declaring a mistrial allows a retrial if there was manifest necessity to stop the court proceedings. So my limited understanding of manifest necessity is that it characterizes the burden of the prosecutor, that he must shoulder it in justifying a retrial according to Cornell's annotated constitution. So this means that in cases of hung juries, the double jeopardy clause may not apply. So it seems very gray, very bendable.
Well, I guess it is a little bit, but, you know, he wasn't acquitted. It was just a hung jury.
Right. But so, at that point, prosecutors could have decided not to prosecute, go forward.
Well, yeah, that's the easy answer, is to say, you know, we got a hung jury. We don't have a real case. We'll just drop it.
Right.
But they're looking at 11 people to one, and I'm sure they're thinking, we just get a better jury this time, and we can do it.
And to me, that would mean, let's get a more ignorant jury.
Well, that might not be the polite way of putting it.
No.
They just want a jury
that's more pliable, more easily pliable. Influenced.
Yeah, I mean, they
to their way of thinking.
They almost got it the first time,
which is scary to me.
Except for this guy Siris. I mean, otherwise they had 11 out of the 12.
They did
voting for conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure they're thinking, well, all we need to do is find one person to replace this holdout, and we got him.
But if this Adam Siris had said, well, fuck it, everybody else thinks he's guilty, and I want to go home, which most people probably would have done.
They'd be done by now.
Yeah. I think most people would have given in to that kind of pressure.
Yeah. But I'm sure that's why they're continuing to pursue it.
Yeah.
I mean, there really isn't a case.
I don't think so, but a lot of people do. Actually, Stan and Julie Pates believe that Pedro Hernandez killed Eitan.
Well, again, I know how grief-stricken they are and have always been, but they're grasping at straws. They also want to see someone held responsible for it.
Well, they really want to put it to rest, yeah.
And
I don't blame them at all, of course.
I don't either. But
no.
I don't think they're right in assessment of Hernandez.
Sure, but I'm sure they're influenced by the prosecutors as well, telling them that, of course, he's guilty and supporting that idea.
Sure.
Now, they had the 2004 judgment against Jose Ramos dismissed after the 2015 trial of Pedro Hernandez convinced them that Ramos wasn't responsible. So they bought into it, and they dismissed their judgment against Jose Ramos.
Yeah, I don't know why. I guess they just figured out that, okay, Hernandez is a better bet, and we'll drop the case against Ramos.
I don't know, but just Ramos just seems much more likely to me. He's a pedophile. He knew people. He knew the babysitter. He knew where Eitan's bus stop was.
Right.
He almost confessed, right? He came kind of close to confessing.
Yeah, kind of.
He did say that he'd murdered a child and raped a child at one point who looked like Eitan.
And he's a convicted pedophile.
Yeah, yeah. So to me, he's much stronger suspect.
Yeah, and he's got the history. He's got almost confession.
Right.
He's got the opportunity because he knows the family or knows of the family.
He's got much more motive than Hernandez.
Yeah.
Right. Now, one of the disappointing things was that when the defense wanted Jose Ramos to come in and testify, he said he would just plead the fifth, so that didn't help them.
No.
Although I think I might have brought him out just so the jury could have seen him do that.
Yeah, and have you seen his picture? I mean, he looks
wild. I've seen a lot of him. I've seen interviews, pictures.
Yeah.
In his recent pictures, he really looks terrifying.
He does.
Yeah. So I thought it might have been worthwhile to bring him out anyway.
It might have been a good move by the defense. Even if he takes the fifth, he's just so wild-looking and feral.
Well, and if he's up there to testify, aren't they allowed to bring up things? Like, even though he's going to say, I take the fifth, they could work things into their questions would show the jury how he is a likely perpetrator.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it might have been a good idea to bring him in.
I don't think it would have hurt.
No. So Stan Pate said that We are frustrated and very disappointed that the jury has been unable to make a decision. The long ordeal is not over. This was in May 2015. He said, I'm so convinced that Pedro Hernandez kidnapped and killed my son. His story is simple and it makes sense. But I say, does it really?
Yeah, again, he's told more than one story. The details change a little bit each time.
Right.
So I don't know how you can be convinced based on conflicting stories, or maybe not conflicting stories, but changing stories.
But I really can't think of any other case where someone grabs a child and just kills them right away and gets rid of their body. Usually they do something to the child. It's horrible to think of, but usually that's what happens.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Usually they're abducted, sexually abused, and killed. And this takes place from some studies within 3 hours of the abduction.
Right.
The typical child abduction is taken, raped, and killed in 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, as long as you've brought it up, why don't we go into your statistics on missing children and childhood abduction? I know you have some stuff there.
Well, just a little. I mean, there isn't that much that we haven't really talked about. I think the first thing is that the murder of an abducted child is a rare event. Now, they say, and this is from two or three years ago study, 100 incidents in the United States per year. So, I mean, it says rare, but 100? It seems like a lot.
It does. But I guess when you're thinking about the whole human population.
Right.
I'm sure it's too many, though. It's definitely 100 too many.
Exactly. So, and you want to do immediate action.
Right.
Because there typically is about a 2-hour delay in making the report. So you're already a couple hours behind.
Well, because people usually look and try and figure things out on their own before they call the police. Yeah.
And as we said, most kids that are murdered are dead within 3 hours of the abduction.
Yeah.
So most of these child abduction murders are committed by a killer who's a total stranger to the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Although that varies with gender and age of the victim.
Yeah, those statistics were interesting. Why don't you share some of those with us?
Well, the youngest females, those are 1 to 5-year-olds, tend to be killed by friends or acquaintances. But the older females, 16 to 17, tend to be killed by strangers. On the male side, both youngest and oldest male victims are likely strangers that have done the act. Average age of the killers of the abducted children is around 27. Mostly unmarried. Half of them either live alone or with their parents. Half of them, again, are unemployed. The employed ones are generally working in unskilled or semi-skilled labor occupations.
Yeah.
Most of them have prior arrests for violent crimes, with slightly more than half of these prior crimes committed against children. So there's a history, which Hernandez doesn't have.
Right. And Hernandez would have been 18 at the time of this.
Right.
Yeah.
So, crash, I'm making noise, sorry. I found this part interesting. Once the murder investigation has begun, the name of the killer is likely to be in the investigative file within the first week.
Yeah, I found that really interesting.
So it gives an opportunity for investigators who might run out of leads to just look over the case again.
Yeah, you need to go back and look over anybody you've talked to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're likely to have the perpetrator there.
Yeah.
That's an amazing fact.
That is really interesting.
So then what they finish up with, what can we tell parents to help them protect the children?
Well, this is important, yeah.
So perhaps the most important single thing to protect our kids is to be certain that they play while they're supervised.
Yeah.
Even in their own front yard or neighborhood street. Now, when I was a kid,
yeah,
we roamed all over the place. Well, as long as I was home for dinner, I was okay.
Well, that was the thing in our family. You need to be in when the streetlights come on.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's really, I'm sure I'm not the only old person who said that, but it's really sad that we can't do that anymore.
We can't.
I remember going out after breakfast and being out all day, and I probably didn't go more than 3 or 4 blocks from my home, but I had all kinds of adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and particularly trick-or-treating. I mean, we'd roam all over the place without parents being with us.
Yeah. But that's part of this A10 Pate story, is that changed things not only in that neighborhood, but nationwide.
So then besides better supervision of our kids, we've got to teach them stranger danger.
Right.
So don't speak to strangers. Don't get into cars with strangers. Probably should even carry it a step further, not to even approach a car, whether the occupant of the car is a stranger or not.
Well, that's a big thing.
No matter what they say.
Because even if you don't get in, kids have come close to the car and they get grabbed and pulled in.
They get snatched, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you need to be aware of strangers' unusual behavior in the neighborhood. Write down descriptions of people, vehicles, license numbers. A lot of abductions might be witnessed by people that aren't aware they're witnessing a crime.
I found that interesting, yeah. People might think it's a parent just disciplining
disciplining an unruly kid.
Right. But it might actually be an abduction.
Right. And then I think that the final thing was, if you can't find your child, call the police right away. Don't spend valuable time looking for the child on your own.
Right. Call the police before you call all the neighbors and go look around. Right. Just call them right away.
Call them right away.
Yeah. Well, that's good advice. But I found that really fascinating, that the person has probably already been talked to by police.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because most of them take place in the neighborhood. So the perpetrator usually lives near the abducted child.
That's true. Well, it was only a few days ago, October 6th. What's today, the 11th?
Yeah.
Yeah. October 6th, jury selection began for the retrial of Pedro Hernandez. So there was a mistrial, but now they are going to retry him.
They are.
So an estimated 90% of 120 prospective jurors appearing last week said they had concerns about their availability to hear the trial, which is expected to last until late January 2017. According to the New York Times, the group began murmuring as soon as they heard the case was about the 1979 abduction of A.T.N. Pates.
Yeah, I'll bet they were.
I mean, I don't know if it's a bad thing about me, but I would be excited. I'd want to be in on that. I'd want to be a juror.
Well.
Because I think it's fascinating, and I'd like to be able to have my opinion be part of it.
Possibly. But it's also tremendously time-consuming.
Yeah.
I mean, the initial trial lasted how long? 3 months?
5 months.
5 months.
Yeah.
So that's an awful long time to be a juror.
It
and
is.
And not be doing your field of work.
Yeah. Well, I guess for me, it'd be more interesting than my field of work.
Well, sure.
I'd still have to do podcasts in the evening, but I think I could commit to that.
Yeah.
And then some actually...
They wouldn't pick you anyway, because your opinion wouldn't agree with what the prosecution wants in their juror.
Yeah. They'd say, have you heard about it? I'd say, yes, and let me tell you.
Right.
Let me tell you what I think.
So they'd boot your ass out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Now, some people actually groaned when they heard that the trial would probably last until January 2017. But now Judge Wiley, he told the potential jurors that sitting on the trial would likely be one of the most significant events in their lives, and they would almost never be bored. And I agree with him. I think that jury duty is not only our responsibility, but it's fascinating. It's important. I totally believe in jury duty. I could be a full-time juror. I like it.
Maybe you should do, you could be one of those jury pickers.
Oh, I think that's a whole other thing. You have to know some psychology. You have to know how to profile them.
Right, but that'd be a good job.
It'd be fun, yeah. But I don't think I'm qualified in any way, no.
I don't know what the qualifications are.
I don't know.
Someone who's observant.
Someone who's observant. I don't know if they're an attorney for a while first. I don't know how that works, but it would be interesting.
Right.
Yeah. Now, A-10 has never been found, and the trial is set to begin in November, the next trial for Pedro Hernandez.
That's assuming they can impanel a jury.
Yeah, well, they will. I'm sure they will.
Yeah, but it's going to take a while.
I would think a lot of younger people don't know of A-10 Pates.
Right.
I mean, actually, I didn't remember. I had vague memories of it, but, you know, that was a long time ago. I wasn't an adult back then, so I didn't really remember it. I remembered Adam Walsh more. But I remember when I read the book, Adam Walsh was like less than 2 years later, and they all went on the Donahue Show and did a lot of things together. I think it was the Pateses, the Walshes, and another couple. Can't remember their name.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do remember Adam Walsh was a big deal because he was in the store. His mom went to another department, which my mom used to do all the time.
Right.
She'd leave me in one department. She'd go do her thing.
Comes back and there's no child.
Yeah. He was sitting there. I guess video games were just coming out and they were playing. Some kids were playing a video game in the Sears. And she went to look at lamps. And when she came back, one of the people that works at Sears had kicked the older kids out. And she didn't know if Adam had been kicked out with these other kids or grabbed by someone else.
Right.
But that was horrifying. Really scary.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. Really bad. So, do you have anything else to say about this case?
Well, the only thing I'd say is that I think they're prosecuting the wrong person.
I agree with you. And I tried not to have a predetermined opinion on this before I did the podcast, but it was really hard not to once I saw things and read the book.
If all you read about is that they had a guy who confessed to it and there was a hung jury, you're thinking, well, sure, they should go retry him.
Right.
But when you find out the particulars of it, at least it makes me think they're barking up the wrong tree. They're after a guy who didn't do it.
Yeah, I really think so. Especially after you see the interviews with Ramos.
Yeah.
I just really see him as a much better suspect, a much better person to prosecute.
Absolutely. I do too.
Yeah. But Pedro will be retried, and then we'll do an update and see what happens.
Okay. And then maybe they'll get around to charging Ramos.
They might.
Because he's never been charged in this.
No, he hasn't. And I think what really would need to happen is someone else would have to come forward or they'd have to find some physical evidence.
Right.
Which is hard to believe that it would ever happen at this point. It's been so long. I don't know if that would happen.
It's unlikely.
Yeah, I know. So let me just do a little groveling before we leave.
Okay, grovel away.
So there are a couple of ways that you can support True Crime Brewery. If you go to our website, www.tiegrabber.com, you can click on Team Tiegrabber Perks. And there are 3 levels of support starting at only $2 a month. So for your support, you'll receive a perk from the brewery. And also in the works, we will have some episodes that only members will get, some premium episodes. And if you want a free and easy way to offer your support, we also have an Amazon gift card and Amazon Audible links on our website. And also on the front page, if you click on Shop at Amazon and support Tiegrabber, anything that you buy on Amazon that you'd normally buy, they'll kick back a few pennies to us from your purchase without you spending any additional money.
I like that.
So that's a great way to do it. And as far as Audible goes, I'm a customer and I love to listen to books while I'm driving, when I'm doing chores. Also in bed, sometimes I'm lazy and I don't want to have to read and I'll just lay there and listen to the book as I fall asleep. And it's great. So give Audible a try. You get a 30-day free trial and we get a little kickback for your signing up, even if you don't spend anything and you decide you don't want it.
There you go.
And so it's October, so as you begin your holiday shopping soon, you can also click on the Amazon gift card link on our website's front page. You can buy Amazon gift cards, and those are great for those impossible to buy people in your life, like adult children, right? They're easy, right. They make them happy, they can pick out and buy whatever they want. So those are great.
Those are great.
I think we give those to everybody.
We do.
Yeah.
Because we have adult kids and because we're lazy.
Yeah, and if you buy them for certain stores or Starbucks, sometimes they won't use the whole card, so a couple bucks just goes to waste, right?
Right.
So I think it's much better to use the Amazon gift card. And that way, even if they're running out of money, whatever's left can go past towards their next purchase, and it gets used up, so you're not wasting anything.
It'll all get used.
Yep. Another cool thing is if you go to our On True Crime Movies link on our website, I've posted a link which gives you a 1-month free trial of Showtime Anytime. And if you sign up using this link, we receive a little something from Showtime. And on Showtime, you can watch Ray Donovan, Shameless, The Affair. And with Showtime Anytime, you can access all the way back to season one with any of these and just, you can binge watch two or three seasons. Or with Shameless, I think you can binge watch six seasons. Plus, they started season seven. Well, so you can get a ton of binging out of that for free for 30 days.
All right.
So that's a good thing to try if you don't have Showtime. And also, I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of True Crime Brewery. Our podcast is available on Stitcher. It's available on iTunes. It's available on Google Play. You can also go to our website to access it. And if you like the podcast, follow us on Twitter at TigerRubberPods and Instagram, TigerRubberPodcasts. We also have a Facebook page, which I update a few times a week. And you can see that page. You can give us a like. And that's at TigerRubber.com/Facebook. And all 5-star reviews are appreciated on iTunes as well. If you submit one, we'll happily welcome you to the brewery and read it on one of our upcoming episodes.
We love getting those.
We do. We need more of those because those help us to get more listeners.
Exactly.
And we love to read them too because they're really cool. You can be critical. You can just give a little feedback. As long as you give us 5 stars, we're happy.
That's right.
Yeah. Concluding this episode, I'd just like to say thank you.
And I'd say thank you too. And I would also just interject one other thing. We're going to be going to a niece's wedding, and because of that, we're going to be broadcasting the next True Crime one day later.
Yeah, so we'll probably be recording next Wednesday night and putting it up for Thursday instead of Wednesday, so it'll just be a day late.
Just a day late.
Day late, not a dollar short.
No.
No.
But I know everybody's going to be tuning in Tuesday night looking for us and saying, where the fuck are they?
Oh, geez. Oh, no. People will be freaking out.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I just thought if we...
Good thing to warn everybody. We don't want to cause complete chaos and have the next apocalypse.
We don't want the Earth's axis to shift, anything like that. So.
So thanks, Dickie. You saved us all.
I did.
Okay. So we'll talk to you later.
Next week.
Okay. Wednesday. From the brewery, signing off.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.